Okay, so we can move on to the next sutta. The next one is called Themes from the Anguttara Nikaya 5. And we are still working on the idea of right effort, the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, part of this gradual training scheme. And this particular sutta, we have looked at how to deal with ill will. We have dealt how to look a little bit with sensuality, and this is more how to deal with the idea of impermanence is what we're looking at now. The fact that things are unreliable, uncertain, always changing. So this is really to do with impermanence and some specific contemplation that to deal with that particular subject. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about this. So this is how he goes. Because there are these five themes that should often be reflected upon by a woman or a man, or by a householder or one gone forth. What five? A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I'll be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. So these are the five things to be reflected upon. These are quite a well-known sequence. And what is interesting here, of course, is that it includes everyone. Specifically says women, men, householders, and those gone forth. So it's kind of a very broad topic that includes everyone. It's rare that the Buddha is so specific that everyone is included. Although most of the path, of course, is universal, it applies to everyone. Here he kind of makes it very specific. And what that means then, that these must be very fundamental aspects of living the spiritual life that really kind of aids you on this path and makes you do the basic things that are required for this for the path to work out. These are contemplations to be done frequently. The Buddha specifically says, we'll see that further down. So these are important things. Interesting here that it says a woman or a man. Usually in the Pali, it has the most important word usually is first. So I'm not sure if it really makes much difference here. But here you have woman first, right? Which is kind of nice for a change. Usually it's the other way around with things. So that's kind of a small little difference there. So that is the summary. As very often the Buddha, again, he has a summary first. Then we go into the details afterwards. So let's have a look at the first one of these. For the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with the youth, and when they are intoxicated with the youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. So the purpose of this reflection is to practice better sila. That's really the purpose here. Because you remove some of that distortion of the mind, the intoxication. Yeah, I'm young, I'm strong, I can do whatever I like. The world is my oyster. Let's get out there and kind of have fun and have a good time without reflecting properly upon the consequences of what you're doing. And as I said before, the Buddhist idea is that intoxication has so many different varieties. It's not just intoxication with alcohol. Anything which kind of distorts your feeling of the world is a kind of intoxication. And we tend to think that the state that we have now is kind of the natural state. This is how things are going to be. This is kind of a natural experience for human beings. If you get depressed, you think, oh, this is going to last forever, and you commit suicide because you cannot see an end to these things. When you're healthy, you think, oh, health is going to keep on going, and you get very disappointed when you get sick and these kind of things. We have this delusion that the current way things are now, this is how it's going to be in the future. And this is one of the hindrances on the Buddhist path, because it feels like my character, this is what I'm like. And it's very hard to consider oneself in a different light, to see oneself as a lot happier, a lot more, you know, quite different, because as you develop the path, you change. So that feeling of a sense of self actually gets in the way of this perception that we are able to actually change quite significantly, to become different, to be somebody else, to be a better person than we were before, more joyous, more happy, all of these positive things. This is an important thing to consider in its own right, to remember that your personality, who you are now, is not a fixed entity. It's very flexible, and that is actually one of the things that allows the Buddhist path to be developed. And when you remember that, it actually helps you to develop the Buddhist path. And it's a nice thing, right? When you change for the better, you feel better about yourself. You realize it's actually a very positive thing that this sense of self is not so established and strong and always present, etc. So this is one of the problems here. You remind yourself of the reality. Old age is just around the corner. Old age is the flip side of youth. I'm old. The very fact that the word youth only exists because old age exists. And so there's two sides of the same coin. It's already inside of you, just waiting to come out, basically. Yeah, and if you're old, then the youth is kind of waiting to come out because you kind of get reborn somewhere again. So these things are already part of you. So you kind of feel that old age, even when you're small, young, you just feel that old age inside. You feel it's already there. It's already part of you. It's already just waiting to show itself. Before you know it, all the signs of old age will be there. And this is then kind of wise reflection. Of course, the earlier you grasp this, the younger you are, when you grasp these things, the more powerful they are, because it gives you more of an opportunity to practice the spiritual path and do things that are truly useful in life, rather than waste your time with the intoxication of youth, mess around and do things that are counterproductive in so many ways. So this is the idea of this kind of reflection, and it really is a reflection on impermanence, on how things always are so unreliable. You cannot really hold on to anything here. So that's old age for you. Let's have a look at the second one here. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. In a state of health, beings are intoxicated with their health. And when they are intoxicated with their health, they engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. And when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with health is either completely abandoned or it is diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to illness, not exempt from illness. So again, exactly the same thing as before. Health and illness are two sides of the same coin. So if you are healthy, then illness is just waiting to kind of come out and say, and kind of scare you, and give you a scare. So it's always there, just waiting to come out. One of the nice things about Ajahn Brahm is that he kind of gives you sometimes these teachings that are really profound, but he gives them in such a way as if there's nothing more to it than a joke kind of thing. That's kind of the way he usually works his teachings. But often, if you listen to them carefully, there's actually an important message behind the apparent kind of jokey surface of things. And that is one of those things is this idea, you go to the doctor and say, Doctor, doctor, something is right with me today. Yeah, I'm sick again today. Something is right. And it's actually quite profound when you think about that. Because most of us, we feel something has gone wrong when you are sick. But actually, nothing has gone wrong. This is what you have to expect. And the person who has really understood this, he will say the right thing to the doctor when he goes there. So this is one of those things. And of course, if you have that attitude, then you will never be intoxicated by the fact that you are healthy. You will never go around, jump around. Yeah, health, this is mine, this is me. I am this really healthy person, right? And then you get really a shock when you when illness comes after all. So sometimes it's also nice to see people who are ill, right? Go and visit them in hospital. See people who are sick, see what they look like when they have some really debilitating disease that really you feel get really emaciated and really bad. It's actually it drives home the message that this is the reality of things. Of course, it is so easy sometimes to think that this applies to other people. And of course, the important thing is to drive it home that it also applies to me as well. I too can get sick in exactly the same way. And it's quite useful sometimes, you know, when you have family members who get sick, that is kind of the position I'm in right now, then it actually makes that message so much stronger. And this is one of the benefits of having a family member who is sick. It may sound a weird thing to say a benefit, but actually with every, you know, what they say, every cloud, there is a silver lining. In this case, maybe it's with every silver cloud, there is a... No, with every silver, there's a cloud. No, I'm not sure how that would work. It's almost like the reverse. It's not just a silver lining. It's actually the whole cloud is silver. It's just on a little bit of darkness there if you use these things in the right way. So this is the nice thing about it, the positive side of having a family member who dies. And it's kind of strange, you know, when I think about myself and how I viewed life and death before I became a monastic, I would probably take these things it would be very difficult for me to deal with these kind of things. Family members who are dying, passing away before the time is kind of considered ripe, they haven't even reached old age yet, and these kind of things. But now I think of it in a very different way. And I think of it more like, well, you know, this is the way it is. And as long as they have lived reasonably well, good lives, they have, and that is the case for most of my family members, then it's not such a big deal, not a big problem. Just another transition going from one state to another one, and you carry on wherever you go afterwards. So what's the big problem? There isn't really any big problem there. The biggest problem is the attachment. If you are really strongly attached, that is the problem, not the death. So it really has to do, when we grieve very often, it has to do with ourselves, not so much with the other person. So this is the idea of illness, and just remembering that illness is completely natural. It is a part of life. And of course, that kind of wakes you up to the reality of things. This is one of the problems with the idea of impermanence, unreliability, and all of that kind of stuff. Okay. And we come to the next one. The next one is the death contemplation. And this is the most important one of these three that we have been looking at. So, and for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. During their lives, beings are intoxicated with life. And when they are intoxicated with life, they engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with life is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to death, I am not exempt from death. So again, the purpose here is to get rid of this intoxication. And this, I think, is one way of understanding the idea of intoxication here, is this idea that when you remember death, desires and anger and these kind of things that relate to this world tend to fade away. And sometimes you see somebody who was dying on their deathbed, somebody who has kind of reflected on these things, who had kind of practiced in the spiritual path in a good way, and they are at ease with dying. And very often you will see a person like that is so peaceful on their deathbed. They are really relaxed, really at ease. And one of the reasons why they are peaceful is precisely because they know they're out of here. They're out of this world. They are moving on. They're finished with this world. And because you are finished with this world, there's nothing really to desire about this world. Yeah. You're not going to think about all the things you're going to kind of get, your career, your relationships, all that kind of stuff. If you're on your deathbed, all of that is irrelevant. You're not going to think about your next house or next car if you are lying on your deathbed. All of that out, no more interesting. And with that ending of desire, ending of craving, not ending perhaps, but large reduction of that, you become serene, you become peaceful on your deathbed. Ill will, same kind of thing. You're about to die. You're not going to kind of have an argument with your family on your deathbed. The last thing you do is have a massive argument. That would be really, really crazy, right? So on your deathbed, you don't want to have and do that kind of stuff. You just want to get rid of that. This world is finished. And now all you want to do is be peaceful and quiet. And this is what happens if you have lived well. You're able to dying well, the answer to dying well, how to do that is always live well, and then dying well happens as a consequence. So this is kind of the idea then with the death contemplation, is to bring, instead of waiting till the moment you're going to die, bring that peace that's supposed to come on your deathbed, bring it into the present moment. Yeah, that's the whole point. So you remember death now, and when you remember death now, it actually makes you peaceful in the present moment because you abandon those desires, all those defilements right here, right now. So to be able to do that, what you have to do is you have to make it real. When you are on the deathbed, it's real. In the same way, you have to make it real now, as if you really are going to die. Yeah. So how can we do that? And one of the ways that the Buddha explained this in the sutta, a very simple way, is just to remember all the things that can kill you at any time, all the things you can die from. Yeah, you walk onto the streets and suddenly somebody comes and they kind of mow you down, bang, finished. Or, you know, you just walk down a path in the forest here and you stumble on the root. Sometimes people die from the weirdest kind of things. And you trip on a root somewhere and fall over, and somehow you fall in such a way that you die from that. Or you have a heart attack, right? People have heart attacks all the time. Or you have a cancer inside of you that's just waiting to kind of really, really take over your entire body. And sometimes people die incredibly quickly because the cancer has already spread throughout their bodies. There are so many ways in which we can die, so many uncertainties. And I was going to, I don't want to scare you, but sometimes there are snakes around, right? So there are snakes around. It's very rare. I see maybe one snake a year usually around here. And usually they are really afraid. But it is conceivable. Yeah, it is possible. You can be bitten by a snake. And then you think stupidly, ah, it's only a small snake. No worries. I'm just going to keep on going. And of course, small snakes are just as venomous as the big ones. So then you've had it perhaps. So there's always, these possibilities are always there, always around. There's always a degree of uncertainty about life. And one day you are going to die. The only way you're going to be ready when it eventually happens is by being ready now. That day when you die is very, quite possibly a day like just like today. So if you're not ready now, you're not going to be ready when it actually happens. Now is the time to be ready. I could be dead, yeah, in a week, tomorrow. This maybe later on this afternoon. Yeah, you bring it into the present moment, closer and closer to you. And the Buddha said the ideal way of doing the death contemplation, and this is a really hard thing to do, the ideal way, he says, is to be ready to die on your next breath. Yeah? It's hard to imagine, right? It's very, very, very hard to imagine because it's so close to us. But that is the ideal way, because if you do that, then of course there is all of those, that stupidity, that silliness that pertains to this world will be gone. There will be nothing there anymore to worry about. And this is how that happens. So This is how that death contemplation ideally works. Somebody asked yesterday if we can do a death contemplation and a metta meditation. Maybe tonight we can try the death contemplation. Tomorrow is the last day. Maybe it's bad to do the last day death contemplation. So do the death contemplation today. Maybe we can do metta contemplation tomorrow. If you don't feel like doing the death contemplation, please don't. If you feel uncomfortable about that or whatever, no need to take part in that. You can sit here if you like and do other meditation, or you don't have to come at all if you feel uncomfortable with that. That's perfectly okay. So important to feel at ease with these things, because some people find it very hard to contemplate death, and that's fair enough. There's no shame in that at all. It's just that, you know, so you just look after yourself and make sure that you do the right thing that actually works for you. So death contemplation, and it can be very useful, and it can be also used in more practical ways. I was mentioning to somebody the other day that I remember there was a man, he was originally from Sri Lanka, and he was living, I met him in Brisbane when I was there, he was a psychologist, and he told me a very practical way of using death contemplation. He said that every morning when he leaves his house, he makes sure that he tells his wife and his children, he kind of leaves them in a good way, because he knows, today I might die. Yeah, I might die today, so I'm going to have to leave my house in a good way. And of course, that is true of everyone. Every time you meet somebody, every time you have some kind of interaction with somebody, it could be the last time you see them. So how do you want that last interaction with that person to be? A good one or a bad one? More important with our family members, but with everyone, it's nice to have that same idea. Leave them in a good way. This could be the last time. So this is a very useful way of using this death contemplation, the idea of impermanence. So, very nice contemplation. So I would, because the Buddha makes so much of it, and almost all spiritual traditions around the world, they have some sort of death contemplation. So it is kind of, this is one of those things that people with some idea of a spiritual path, what they usually tend to think about. And it doesn't make you sad, doesn't make you depressed. If it does, it means you're using it in the wrong way. It's supposed to lift you up and actually enrich your life if you use this kind of contemplation correctly. It brings you into the moment, makes you more mindful. It takes away some of that dreaminess that we were talking about earlier today, and actually allows you to live your life more fully if you do these things properly. Okay. So let's have a look at the next one. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. Beings have desire and lust in regard to those people and things that are dear and agreeable, and excited by this desire, I think is better, they engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. And when one often reflects upon this theme, that desire and lust in regard to everyone and everything dear and agreeable is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. So, again, it's one of those things that on the surface of it may seem kind of depressing, right? But it's just reality. And if we can accept reality, it makes it so much easier to live our life in a good way and in the right way. Hiding, trying to pretend that reality is not reality, is never going to be very useful. It's just delusion. And when you are deluded, you end up precisely being intoxicated and stupid and all of these things. And again, remember that this is very broad, right? Everything dear and agreeable is very all-encompassing. There's so much that is included in that. Exactly, this is very similar to the reflection earlier on today, the idea of borrowed goods. Same kind of thing. Everything must be separated and parted, right? It's exactly the idea of borrowed goods again. Things are borrowed, and so much of our life is borrowed. So much more than we normally actually consider. And the degree to which we are attached to the things around us. Sometimes it is astonishing to see how attached we are to the things around us. We are so attached and we are so desperate when we come to kind of reach our death, right? We are so attached, we'll do anything to be able to kind of carry those things, bring those things with us into the future. And this is one of those interesting things, and some of the traditional cultures, sometimes you have this idea, one of these ideas to try to take everything with you from this life into another one. You have sometimes these traditional cultures where you burn little paper models of things, right? So you have a kind of a little paper money, you have a paper house, you have a paper car, right? I want to take my BMW with me into the future life. So you burn that paper BMW at your funeral service, and then the smoke goes up and it goes into heaven and it waits for you in heaven when you get there. And I think this is quite common around the world. You find this kind of thing, not exactly like that, but varieties of that theme, right, around the world. And you know, being Norwegian, I know what happened to know a little bit about the Viking culture. And the Viking culture was also like that. And the Viking culture was when the Viking died, he was kind of the head man or whatever, right? And he would have a Viking ship. And then he would take the Viking ship and he would fill all his worldly possessions into this Viking ship, including his wives, right? And his wives were probably still alive. So this was also a very cruel practice at the same time. And then he put his body on board and then he would set light to the whole thing and the whole thing would burn. So you could take all your wives. You have to have your Viking ship in heaven, right? So the Viking ships get taken to heaven as well. And everything goes to heaven as a consequence. So this is how attached we are to our things in life. And we try, even on our deathbed, against all reason, we try to bring those things with us into the next life. But this is how it happens, even though it is obviously it's obviously quite foolish in one way. But I guess there's nothing to lose, you know. You burn a few paper cars and houses, it's not a big deal. So you try that and hope that that will have some kind of effect. So important, so useful to kind of get over that as soon as possible. All your belongings, everything, your body, and also, as I was saying before today, so many of our mental things as well belong to this world. All these things that we have built up in terms of social position, education, work achievements, our identity as family members, where we belong to, our religion, all of these things belong to this world in a certain sense. And often we are attached to these things. Very often we are attached to the way the world functions, the world works in a certain way, and then the kind of politics change or the wars break out and all these kind of things. And that is another thing that we are that is dear and agreeable to us. And then we kind of despair a little bit when the world kind of goes in the wrong direction and things seem to be going downhill. So all of those things are included in that. So again, one of those basic things to remember on this path. And as you do that, you lose some of your attachments, right? And as you lose some of your attachments, you live more peacefully, you live more at ease. An important thing to remember here to enable us to do this, because you cannot, often the attachments are there because these are the things that give us happiness and meaning in life. So an important part of this, there's two sides to our ability to let go of attachments. On the one hand, what we have to do is that we have to build up another happiness inside of us. And by building up that other happiness inside of us, we have something else that we can hold on to. And then that makes it easier to let go of attachments in this world. So that's why the practice of the spiritual path and our ability to let go of things, they actually go together. Because we are finding meaning somewhere else, finding happiness and contentment somewhere else in life. Sometimes you hear Buddhists say, oh, you know, I want to be a good Buddhist. I've got to let go. I've got to give up these attachments. But it's not a matter of choice. You can't just give up attachments. Your ability to let go of attachments comes from how you develop the spiritual path in the first place. You find happiness somewhere else. Then you have the ability to let go of things. These things go together. Okay, let us look at the last one of these five. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus? I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my refuge. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. People engage in misconduct by body speech of mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, such misconduct is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus. I am the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma. I have kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever kamma, good or bad, that I do. So this is a reflection on kamma, so just a reflection on the fact that our experience of the world depends on how we behave, and that is sufficient very often to change our way of acting and then create a better future for ourselves. One thing is the theory about these things. Yes, you may have some confidence in the theory of kamma, kamma vipaka, kamma and its results. You may feel that this makes sense and the world is, the world functions in this way. But I would recommend you to see how this actually works in practice in your own mind. Because when you see how, when you can actually feel this directly, it becomes far more of a powerful motivation, a motivating force in your life. And this is, kamma is often divided up in the suttas, often divided up into the kamma that you experience here and now, the kamma that you experience in future lives, and the kamma that you, in the next life, and kamma that you experience in lives beyond that. The only kamma that you can really see in this life, of course, is the result that you get straight away. And it's very useful to see that, to try to feel that for yourself, see how your actions right here and right now have an immediate result straight away, how that affects you. If you are sharp and you have enough mindfulness, you will notice that whenever you do something kind, even just thinking a kind thought, it will tend to have an effect straight away. You feel better about yourself. And of course, the point here is that it's not just one act that makes you feel better, and then makes you feel better for a while, and it disappears again. The point is that for every act you do that makes you feel better, you are accumulating something, and it's lifting you up, allowing you to accumulate that goodness inside. And this is the point here. And you don't really lose it. Yes, okay, the immediate effect may be particularly powerful, but you don't really go down to the same level you were before. There's a remnant there. There is a residue which actually leaves your mind slightly lighter, slightly more happy, energetic than what it was before. And every time you do that, you build it up, yeah? And if you can see that, if you can see how this works in action, it becomes a very powerful and motivating force to do what is good, even to think kind thoughts about others, because that feeling, that kindness inside actually has a very, has a positive effect on you. And the exact opposite, right, when you do something which isn't so nice, feel that, how it affects your mind. And it's almost kind of, if you see it clearly, it's almost a bit frightening, because you can see how you're letting yourself down and how you're causing suffering for yourself every time you do something which isn't quite right. It's as if you're dragging yourself down into the dirt, yeah? And you feel bad about yourself, you feel negative. And it becomes very apparent after a while that if you keep on accumulating those bad acts, whoa, it's going to lead to a very bad destination at some stage. And then, of course, the point here is that as you do that, as you accumulate the goodness, as you don't do the badness, you're lifting up your mind, that mind which then is elevated, lifted up, is light and kind of buoyant. That mind, of course, is precisely the mind that you bring with you into the future life. And that is how you then become the heir of that kamma, heir of those actions. Sometimes we think that we can just forgive ourselves if we do bad things. And of course, we can to some degree forgive ourselves. But the point is, to some degree, the sum there is the important point. Forgiveness can never be complete. And the reason it cannot be complete is because we feel that we are responsible. We have to take ownership of our actions to some degree. This is what the sense of self is all about. As long as you have a sense of self, you will take some degree of ownership of your actions. You have no choice. So you forgive yourself as far as you can, but then there is a residue there of responsibility, of guilt, if you like, of shame, or whatever you want to call it, whereby you feel bad about yourself that you did what you did. And you can't really get rid of that, because that's what the sense of self does to us. It forces us to take that responsibility. So then, once you see this, then, of course, you... It really empowers this ability to do what is right, to do what is good. And that really is, to me, the best way of reflecting on karma, because it actually, it is real. It actually is something that you can feel in your own life. Okay, so those are those five reflections. And then we have how these reflections are taken even further. And how we kind of take those all the way to the end of the path. This is what comes next here. So this noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to old age, not exempt from old age. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, are subject to old age. None are exempt from old age. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So, what is happening here is that we are moving from our own personal experience to universalizing that experience, understanding that all beings, wherever they are, whether they are human or they are animals or they are ghosts or they are gods or they are Brahmas or they are whatever they are, any being, any kind of conglomeration of the five khandhas that is found in any kind of existence whatsoever, all are subject to this. All are subject to old age, to passing away and all these kind of things. And what is the point of that? And the point of that is that all beings is equivalent to the possibilities we have in terms of being reborn, right? If we understand that all of these beings are subject to the same thing, we also understand that anywhere we get reborn, we will be subject to the same problem. So this is really about us in the final analysis. You understand that there is no rebirth where you can escape these things. There is no permanent place in this universe whereby now I will be safe forever and after. You can't find that. Old age is everywhere. This is one of the kind of basic principles of this universe, of this samsara universe, probably the wrong word, but samsara, that this is actually always has to be. There is no escape from that. And that's what you understand. So it becomes a universal characteristic of existence. And that is where it becomes almost kind of unbearable when you see that. Because you know that forevermore, if you don't get out of this, you're going to have to relive the same problem again and 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 so on ad infinitum without end in sight. And then you feel this, oh, enough, I want to get off this, I don't want to have anything more to do with this. You know, getting old in this one life is difficult enough. I don't want to have to go through all these things, you know, possibly endlessly in the future. And because you understand that, because you get this universal insight into the principle of old age, because you understand that and because you are averse to it, you are repelled by it, because of that, then the path is born. The path being born means you become a stream enter, you become a stream winner, and you are on the highway to Nibbana. The highway has 8 lanes in Buddhism. It's a really big highway here. The 8-laned highway to Nibbana. So that is where you are. So the path is generated. That means that it arises inside of you. Now you know what you have to do, where the path is, what the factors are that need to be done. And then it becomes part of your psychology, becomes part of who you are. You can't get off the path anymore. And that is why it says you pursue that path, you develop it and cultivate it, because that is what happens when you are a stream enterer. You can no longer avoid the development of that path. And of course, it doesn't mean that as a stream mentor you can just chill and just relax. It's still useful to kind of to push yourself a little bit, or to read the suttas to remind yourself of the problems. But essentially, it means that now there is no turning back anymore. So it's a good thing that Nibbana is a happy place. Otherwise, if you can't turn back, it would be rather miserable. So it might as well be happy. So as you do so, the fetters are entirely abandoned. Yeah, the sanyojanas are abandoned. The underlying tendencies are uprooted. So there's no more tendency anywhere within you for greed, for delusion, for anger, for conceit, for views. All these underlying tendencies, all is kind of gone away. And that means you become an arahant. Yeah, the fetters are entirely abandoned. It's kind of interesting here, this reflection on old age, and ultimately that reflection on old age takes you all the way to arahantship in this way here. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I wouldn't recommend you to just reflect on old age and say, yeah, I'm going to become an arahant this way. I wouldn't recommend that, because it's a bit too narrow. But you can see how that becomes a very important part of the path, and then you can actually use that to take you all the way here. So, and then we have exactly the same thing for illness. The noble disciples reflect thus: I am not the only one who is subject to illness, not exempt from illness. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, are subject to illness. None are exempt from illness. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Same idea again. Illness is a universal thing. Every being has to undergo illness. Once you understand the universality of these things, then of course, you start to understand that there is no escape from this. Sooner or later, illness is going to come back to you. Yes, there are certain realms of rebirth where you probably don't get ill. That is true, like the Brahma realms and that kind of thing. But then when you get reborn again from those Brahma realms, then you have to undergo illness again in the future. There is no final exemption from illness in that way. And then the third one, this noble disciple reflects thus: I am not the only one who is subject to death, not exempt from death. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, are subject to death. None are exempt from death. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So this is death, and death is the most important one of these contemplations here, probably of all five contemplations, because death is such a powerful moment that is so obvious that it must happen. Okay, illness is a bit more uncertain, perhaps old age, kind of okay, but death is a very clear point where everything has to be let go of. And when you read the suttas, this is the one that the Buddha talks about the most of all of these five contemplations. Death contemplation you see by far the most in there. Maranasati or Maranasanya is what it's called in the Pali language. So you universalize this. You understand there is no escape from this very problematic time in our lives. We will come back to these things again and again in the future. Next time around, you will not be a Buddhist. You will maybe be something else. Who knows what we will be in our next lives. Whatever. And then, of course, you don't have that kind of, refuge, that thing to help you, to move you and kind of overcome the problems that actually death normally is for us. So right now you have a little bit of support. Other lifetimes we don't have that support. And then it is very, very difficult to face these kind of things. So remember that. This is one of those really big moments in human life that are usually very difficult. One of the things that we are, maybe this is, comes under the next one really, but one of the things that also we have to give up that is dear and pleasing to us very often is our, are these teachings, right? Buddhism itself. And this is kind of, this is also quite scary in a sense. Here you have some wisdom teachings to guide you in life, to kind of get you on the, you know, the right path, the right track. Next life, who knows what's going to happen in your next life? Who knows whether you're going to get reborn in a place where there is any Buddhism? And eventually you will get reborn, guaranteed, in a place where there is no, you don't have this kind of wisdom teachings. And then it's very hard. Buddhism is gone. And if you look at the human realm, sometimes you see Buddhism kind of disappearing. You see all kind of weird expressions of the Buddhist teachings, you know, kind of very simplified versions of Buddhism. Just sit down and repeat a mantra and she'll be fine, right? And no worries, and just repeat this mantra. You go to the you go to visit Amitabha in the kind of pure land, and then no worries. And it's not Buddhism. It's not what the Buddha taught. But somehow people think it can become that simple. So there is this corruption undergoing. And sometimes you wonder how these things, how long they're going to last. And you wonder how corrupt everything is already. And this is an important reflection. When you remember that, it's uncertain. You know, I sit in my monastery, I think, how long is Ajahn Brahm going to be around? What's going to happen? You know, with his diet, you wonder how long he's going to be around. What then? What happens when Ajahn Brahm kind of dies? Yeah, and I don't usually think about it, but anything is possible. And it's kind of a, you know, it's uncertain. Who's going to take charge of the monastery if Ajahn Brahm dies? I'm not going to take charge of the monastery if Ajahn Brahm dies. No way. It's going to, what's going to happen next? Maybe Venerable Kaliko would like to take charge of the monastery. But anyway, and so it is a, so these are the things that remind you of the incredible, they're just this so unreliable, so uncertain, and so who knows where things are going to go next. And this is part, really, part and parcel in many ways of the death contemplation, because things are so so unreliable. So, again, as you do that, yeah, just the death contemplation, if you do it strongly, it can actually lead to the path being generated. Then we have the same thing with the next one. The noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. And as he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned. The underlying tendencies are uprooted. Again, another universal principle, the principle of impermanence. All of the things that we're looking at here are really about impermanence in one way or another. The principle of unreliability, of impermanence, of changeability. Everything is so uncertain, regardless of where you go, regardless of the kind of life you have, the station you have in the world, everything is always the same. So again, that leads you to detachment, right? If you think about this very deeply, it leads you to detach. You detach from everything. There's nothing worth holding on to. And of course, if you can detach from absolutely everything, then that is where the deep insight happens. That's what detachment from everything really is. It is a deep insight into the nature of reality. The path is generated when that happens. And then you end up abandoning the fetters. Fetters are the things that tie you to samsara, right? You are fettered to samsara, shackled. And most important thing among those being craving itself. Actually, sakkaya ditti is really the first one of the important ones. Sakkaya ditti, the feeling of an entity, permanent entity inside. That is the first thing we really see when we get deep insights, the understanding of non-self. That is what the abandoning of sakkaya ditti is about. That's the first thing. And based on that, we can abandon the other fetters, especially the sensual desire binds us on to the wheel of samsara. There's 10 fetters there, but those are probably the two most important ones to keep in mind. Then we have the last one. The noble disciple reflects thus, I'm not the only one who is the owner of my kamma, the heir of my kamma, who has kamma as my origin, kamma as my relative, kamma as my refuge, who will be the heir of my kamma, whether good or bad, that I do. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, are owners of the kamma, heir of the kamma. All have kamma as their origin, kamma as a relative, kamma as their refuge. All will be heir of the kammas, good or bad, that they do. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. And sometimes we think that because of the law of kamma, it means that we can kind of take charge of our happiness and reduce suffering, right? Because it may seem that, yeah, well, I know that if I do good, I will get good results. And so you think that, yeah, I will take charge. This means that there is a kind of a little glimmer of hope in the samsara, because I will just kind of remember that and I will be okay here. The problem is that you can't really remember this. This gets lost right now. The reason why you know it now is because you're conditioned that way. And even then, sometimes it can be difficult to make good karma all the time because the defilements overpower the mind. You forget about the path. You forget what you're supposed to do. You still end up doing silly things sometimes. So this is the problem with karma. It is really an impersonal law. And there's not something that you can decide to always follow this law in the right way so as to control your destiny. It just happens according to cause and effect. Whether you follow according, whether you act according to these ideas or not. And that is the problem. So these are impersonal laws that really in the end you have no control over. That is, I think, one of the faults that people sometimes do. They think that this actually gives rise to control, when really it is just an explanation for how we kind of go up and down in samsara depending on causes and conditions. Anyway, so these are these five themes that the Buddha talks about, and these are found elsewhere in the suttas, and these are important things to contemplate, little things that sometimes you need, little things in your daily life to remind you, like, you know, when you are maybe when things get very hectic and you have many things to do, there are certain things that you can kind of hold on to a little bit, that you can use to remind you of the nature of life. And these are kind of part of that, things to come back to again and again and again to kind of move you in the right direction. And the purpose, of course, ultimately the purpose is to make sure that our sila is always kind of upheld, that we don't lose track, if we don't forget about the importance of sila, to always keep that up. If you keep your sila up, if you're consistently kind, then you're always advancing on the Buddhist path. And these are really to help you with that, because it overcomes those intoxications that drives us away from living in the right way and living well. And then you are on the right track, and you're heading in the right direction, moving towards Nibbana, moving towards all the highest happiness in the universe. Yay, happiness! What a wonderful thing that is. Okay, so that is all for this afternoon. So please keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again this evening. And just to remind you once again, I'll probably be doing a death contemplation this evening. Okay.